out of capital utilization. Terry's been our executive vice president. He's basically the CEO of the Colorado Cattlemen's Association for a decade. And were we the first state Cattlemen's Association?
I don't remember, but that's what they tell me.
That's what they tell me, yes. So Terry doesn't have first-hand experience with it. I just want to just tell you a very short story to give you some idea of the magnitude. Hello, Jessup.
Hello,
from
Brent.
Silvendale.
It's great to see you. Gosh, what a nice surprise.
Well.
It should be.
Okay, so this is David and Susie Jessup, the brother and sister act that are going to entertain us, I guess, of Silvendale. But so let me tell you a quick story. I'm on the board of the Colorado Cattlemen's Agricultural Land Trust, which is a subsidiary of the CCA. And we're actually the largest land trust in the state right now, and wonderful job. Terry attends all of our board meetings. But there was a number of years ago, Terry came and he wanted to address the board of the Cattlemen Ag Land Trust. And he wanted to make sure that our board was not going to take this the wrong way, but Terry was proposing this idea of serving as the broker between private landowners, where so many of our ecosystem services are, because our private lands are biologically by far more productive than our public lands. It's just a sort of a consequence of history. Terry was coming up with thinking of maybe forming a brokerage service where they would mediate contracts for ecosystem services. And I remember this so clearly because it was amazing. Not only did the cattlemen sire this the first of the western states that have a land trust, the cattlemen, Colorado, Terry was conceiving an even actually more imaginative, much more inclusive, much more powerful idea. And that was trying to capture these revenue streams, potential revenue streams, for ecosystem services on private lands, and get those into the hands of the private landowners. And I walked out of there and I told Terry, I said, I don't think there's a person on that board that has a clue of what you're talking about. But he didn't just talk about it. He has formed this Partners for Western Conservation, and he's living the dream. You know, he's still our CEO, but he's trying to balance this ball too. So thank you very much, Terry. Welcome to CSU.
Thanks, Rick. Rick always has a unique story on every introduction that he makes that I look back and I really wonder if that's what happened. Because it's very eloquent in how he explains things and how he kind of tells the story. So I'm going to tell you a little slightly different perspective of that and give credit where I think credit's really due. And that's to the conservation community and the landowners in the state of Colorado and other places. So let me tell you a little bit about myself, a little bit about the Colorado Cattlemen's Association, and then we'll tell you a little bit about Partners for Western Conservation a little bit later. I'm one of those kids that grew up on a ranch and wanted to stay on the ranch. And I just turned 40 years old and I'm not living on the ranch. And but that's okay. It's an okay thing because ranches are an interesting animal. Not only in Colorado, but in other states. And I'm from another state. And they made me use your laptop so you wouldn't see a power cat on the screen from Kansas State University, so that's okay too. It's a land-grant university and we all support those. I'm from the Flint Hills of Kansas. And before I even knew what conservation was, I knew what a ranching ethic was. And my father was fairly attuned to taking care of the land. Maybe not as good as what we could have, but well enough to sustain a vibrant ranching operation as well as a pretty strong population of wildlife and a natural ecosystem there. All of those things that he nor I nor most of us that grew up on ranches, except in the last 20 or 30 or 40 years, really have started to understand is that the world is a lot bigger than just cows. And a lot of people have understood that in the West. I'll tell you, you get into the High Plains, you get into some of the greater grasslands, and there's still a lot to be learned. I say all the time that Colorado's maybe 10 to 15 to 20 years ahead of conservation in Kansas. I'm sure there are places that Colorado learned from otherwise. My father, our ranch operation, our business is big enough for my parents and their family, and it's many of the stories of ranching families. He had the fortitude to at least tell me that I probably should learn and go out and understand things that are going on in other places associated with the ranching lifestyle. And I looked around. I went to graduate school at Kansas State University, undergraduate at Kansas State University. I got one of those cool animal science degrees that a lot of us look around now that have those and go, it's good. I'm glad we've got one of those. I have a bachelor's of science. But there's probably a lot more that went into that ranching business than an animal science degree really taught me. So I continued that effort and got a rooted nutrition degree as well as a graduate student. Again, nice degree to have. And I appreciate it, and I'm proud to have it. But there, looking back, there are a lot of things that I understand that went on that landscape that I probably could have studied more in-depthly that now, luckily, the job that I have at the Colorado Cattlemen's Association allows me to do, and to work with great people like Rick and others at CSU, which I believe is by far the most advanced institution out there really working in this area. And we're proud to be part of it. Colorado Cattlemen's Association was founded in 1867, the nation's oldest cattlemen's association, for what good that is. But we've learned along the way. And we learned to work in a state like Colorado that's very divergent, that we've got to balance things with our ranching businesses. What goes along with ranching that we need to pay a great deal of attention to. So we're a cattlemen's association, the cattle are a tool, both in management of land, for a ranch, but many other things as well. So our organization, 15 years ago, the members of the organization founded the Land Trust. And that's a great conservation tool that we've done well with and our members have benefited from immensely. CSU has been a part of that, as well as a series of other state agencies, private land organizations, conservation organizations, environmental organizations, etc. It is a tool in the toolbox, which philosophically is what our organization's members always wanted. But they don't want a tool, they want tools. They want options, they want flexibility, they want market-driven conservation. So about 3 or 4 years ago, they were looking around the world as it stands in conservation and said, well, we've got this great successful land trust, and we understand the great business models tell us that when you're at the pinnacle of your game, you need to reinvent yourself. That's what great companies do. And assumably what great conservation is all about too, how you add another tool to the toolbox. And we'll talk about that too. But they had us explore the country and look at other things. And this notion of ecosystem services, environmental markets really grabbed their attention. So as it stands today, the majority of traditional ranching and agriculture operations out there are really somewhat monolithic in their thought processes in managing their land. They're great stewards of the land. They do a really good job with it. Could they do more? Absolutely. We raise cattle, we raise hay, we maybe do a little bit of hunting on the side and some things along those lines. Kind of traditional ranching endeavors, landowner endeavors. But is that all that we can do with the land, or many of those things tools in order to managing, you know, appropriately the land? So as we looked at this term, this new thing that was evolving out there, and it's not so new, but it received some new phraseology in the last decade or so. What other services can that land partnered with, and this is a key thing for us in the agriculture community, partnered with that land manager? It's working lands and working hands. We will never deviate from that philosophy as landowners. I want to say that again. We will never set aside land, for the most part. We may take development off of the land, but we'll never just put a piece of parcel of land out there and not use it in some way and leave it set. It goes against our conservation ethic and certainly our land management ethic. But if you start to add things in managing for wildlife and watersheds and water quality and water quantity, are there other deliverables that a working farm or ranch can conceive? So let's digress a little bit, but also it's an important thing that I always like to mention. And Rick mentioned it as well. The Colorado Cattlemen's Land Trust has conserved greater than 350,000 acres of land in the state of Colorado. That's not much of the approximately half of the state's private property, but it's a lot compared to other conservation endeavors. There are certainly groups nationally that have conserved more. They're way older land trusts. This land trust works for landowners for one reason and one reason only. It doesn't try to change who or what they are. It tries to embrace and proliferate the agriculture endeavor that's taking place on the land. It ties the water to the land, which is an important conservation principle, but it's also an important agricultural principle. It doesn't try to go out and look at a landowner and say what you're doing is wrong, and in fact tries to help them manage that land and preserve that land better. And for that reason, your demand's what, 2 to 3 fold for what you can accomplish?
Yeah.
It's a limiting factor of money and time. And you don't take all of the easements that people come to you with. I would venture to say 50% of them either leave because this land trust isn't right for them, or maybe the landowner isn't right for the land trust. So where are we at in Colorado? Between, and these aren't my calculations, I think these are actually Will Schafferoth's information, but between 1997 and 2002, and this is factual information, Colorado lost 1.26 million acres of ag land, over 690 acres a day. That's quite a bit, right? I mean, in many cases, if you get into the mountains and you tie that with federal land holdings, that's a whole ranch a day that went away in Colorado, or more. In many cases, staggered. It's pretty.
What was the time frame again on that?
97 to 02, and that probably would have been kind of the boom period in Colorado, where land conversion was at its pinnacle. But it is estimated by 2022 we'll lose an additional 3.1 million acres of ag land in the state for a variety of reasons. Anything from generational transfer issues, such as young people not wanting to come back to the farm and ranch. You know, CSU does a great job. You raise people to be, young people to be bright and intelligent, and when they come home, you know, unfortunately, in ag, you give them these neat budgets that they're able to do the income and the expense. That's really bad for ag, because when they come home to the income and the expense side of the budget for a ranching operation, it doesn't always equate to, yeah, I'm going to stay here. Sometimes it says, you know, there's a nice, equitable job in town somewhere I'd rather get. But that being said, there are other things. Death tax. Colorado is highly divergent in the sense that it isn't the easiest place to be in agriculture. We have a lot of urban neighbors. Leads to conflicts, leads to lawsuits. Our producers in our organization today are spending as much or more time off the ranch and on off-ranch issues as they are on the ranch, because they're having to deal with species issues and they're having to deal with land use issues. They're dealing with ag literacy issues. They're dealing with issues associated with perceptions of agriculture. And so this is all leading to kind of a theme here. How do we better educate and inform and communicate about agriculture and what its benefits are? The trust, the Conservation Trust, estimates that there's about $1 billion gap in funding to curb land conservation. I think most of this was for easement work primarily, but it's still an indicative factor that says $1 billion is a lot of money. Federal government's broke, right? States are broke, right? Counties are getting there, right? So where does that funding shortfall come from? Myself, my personal philosophy is that maybe we don't need more money, we just need to use what money we have more wisely. We'll see. GOCO, we're one of the few states that has a mechanism for funding conservation like Great Outdoors Colorado. They can only fund 1 in 3 projects. In the state. Cattlemen's Land Trust does a great job of securing a lot of that money. It's not enough. And conservation easements aren't the tool for everyone. They're a tool. So we know that we need more diverse tools, and we know that we need better funding, more funding mechanisms. It's a small Christmas list, isn't it? So as we kind of set the table, if you will, related to conservation, and we look around the country and we say, what are we given? What are the demographics? 71% of our land is in private ownership in the United States. So logic tells us that we've got to find a way, if we're going to be successful with conservation and the things that can go along with conservation, preservation of food security, national security, things along those lines, then we've got to work with private landowners. And guess what? They're a fickle group of people, right? I'm looking at myself when I say that in the mirror. We can be a fickle group of people. Rick sits in these easement land trust board meetings, and we may quibble over the very smallest of things, right? What type of fence is out there? Well, it's none of our business. That's the landowner's business. You know, how will the water be used? Things along those lines. Colorado, for instance, got about, you know, 36% roughly, you know, a little more than a third of our land is public land. So let me give you the demographic in Colorado. 66 million acres, 33 million of that's in private landowner ownership, right? Most of that, 75-80% of that is in agriculture's management, as leased property or owned property. It's a huge private lands reservoir. Most of that is in livestock grazing. I stole this from Rick, one of your friends, but it's a great slide, because I do believe, and I think many of the conservation organizations are starting to believe and have believed, the landowners play a tremendous role in private land in all conservation. Private landowners can and are the future of conservation. They want to be the future. Not all of them, I'm generalizing, but many of them want to be. Over 10.4 million individuals, I'm just going to read this because it's that good. Partnerships and corporations manage over 264 million acres of private forest land. Over 938 million acres of cropland, pastureland, rangeland, owned and managed by 2.1 million farmers and ranchers. And I love this next statement. The care of 50% of our land is in the hands of 2% of our citizens. I don't know if this slide goes on to say it, but that 2%, as it always has been, is rapidly aging. There's a tremendous time period that's before us in agriculture where those lands are going to start to move to the next generation. It's not far ahead of us. Lou, you're the sociologist in the room. I'm going to point you out to Lou Swanson. He can answer these questions for you, or at least give you what the demographics are. I don't know if you can answer it, but you can tell us what's happening out there. The rural society, the agriculture society, the landowner society that exists out there is always aging. It's a given. But there's a great big group of them. As with any company, whether you talk to the Forest Service and the fact that, or USDA, talk to the fact that 50% of their employee base is ready to retire in the next few years. Agriculture is not a lot different, except they retire in a different way. They kind of retire at the end of their lives on the ranch. They remain part of it. Individual landowners steward about 70% of our wetlands, 70% of our endangered species. So think about this. When lands were settled in the West or anywhere else, where do you think human beings naturally gravitated toward? Probably the best lands, right? It's logical. Where there's water and there's fertile soils, where do you think most of species gravitate toward? The same place. So it only stands to reason that critical winter habitat, endangered species habitat, and things like that's going to exist on private lands. So you're all by this point gathering my bias, right? Slowly but surely. We do have a lot of national forests. Landowners in many places play a role in that. When you look at livestock grazing. So let's move forward a little bit. I only pull from this slide to kind of denote a little bit of the shortcomings. It's not important if you can't read it. But what it does talk to and speak to is that federal funding isn't the answer entirely. There's a funding shortfall for all of our conservation programs. Colorado participates in all of these EQIP programs that help us develop water springs, be more efficient for both livestock and wildlife, preserve rivers, to easement-based programs like the Farm and Ranch Protection Program, has changed a little bit of its terminology, GRP, Grasslands Reserve. There's tremendous funding shortfalls in the tunes of tens of hundreds of millions of dollars that exist out there. Colorado, year before last, had one GRP easement. I think there may be more this year. A lot of those GRP easements go to small, very small landscapes in the eastern part of the country. WIP programs, wildlife habitat incentives, there's shortfalls in federal funding. Bobbio says it's about $133 million out of the 2005 census figures. So the thing that we know, again, is that more diverse tools and funding are needed. We don't have enough money. We'll never have enough money. Or do we? Maybe we do. So Partners for Western Conservation. Our membership had us take some field trips across the country and do a little bit of a delivery. And they said, what other tools exist out there that are more hands-on conservation, more prescriptive in nature? Easements are great large landscape conservation tools, but they're somewhat passive. We've argued for many years, Rick, and unsuccessfully, to say that just by not developing the land, you're going to get 90% of the conservation return that you want. That argument really, in my opinion, we've not gotten mainstream to really grab a hold of that. You may get them to gravitate toward, if you never develop things and you do it perpetually, that you'll get there. Landowners have never gravitated toward that unilaterally either. So there's a little bit of a divide there. So we went to Texas and we had a conversation about a species credit system. We looked at what was being done in California and a few other states related to ecosystem services, wetland banks, conservation banks. There's a whole litany of things that exist out there, and we said, you know, it's all market-based, it's incentive oriented, much like easements. There maybe is a tool out there that we can get more landowners to participate in if it's more hands-on conservation, more prescriptive conservation, and that it allows for a greater degree of flexibility. Maybe it isn't perpetual, maybe it's temporal. Maybe it isn't necessarily non-development, but maybe it's actually some sort of tool that can also diminish listing of species. There's the world could be opened with things like simple contracts for conservation. We also knew that we didn't want to take the place of what other organizations were doing. There's no sense in creating another organization to leech funding off of the system. But our landowners said that there wasn't another organization out there that they really felt a tremendous degree of comfort with, and they wanted something that would have a landowner flair and an essence to it, but also be diverse in nature. So PWC was founded. We had a few progressive companies outside of agriculture, actually, that stepped forward and said, we would have interest in this too. Let's get you incorporated. Let's move forward. So we did that. And the organization today has some basic midstream principles to implement market-based conservation and ecosystem programs. We want those to benefit wildlife, environment, landowners, and the regulated community. What is an ecosystem? What is ecology? What do we always leave out of that? That's probably the most impactful on an ecosystem. Loops? Humans, maybe? Yeah? We never consider humans when we talk about an ecosystem. So we put that in there when we said landowners and regulated community. We thought it's better to put that right up front, and let's be honest with ourselves that it's going to entertain all of those things. Humans have to be part of the equation. want to use science. Science is important. We overutilize the term, but it's also very important if you have one to have long-term conservation that it needs to be scientifically based. It needs to be baseline and proven throughout the system. We need to provide assistance to landowners and conservationists alike, and resources are important, and education is imperative. Because if we don't tell our story and we don't communicate that along the way, we're going to be in the same place we are now when the next generation has the same conversation. One good thing about being an old organization is you can go back on your history and you can read about it, and you can see 50 years ago or 60 years ago we were talking about the exact same things then as we're talking about today. And some of them we started to solve, but some of them we haven't. But one thing we know by looking at our history and seeing it a couple times, the same discussions, we know our future is going to be the same. So we're on the right track at least. A community of partners is important. There's many landowner collaboratives out there. There's landowner conservation collaboratives out there. But again, not to recreate what everyone else has done, but to simply be an implementation body, we knew we needed to have those entities around the table, and they needed to be committed to conservation, stewardship of land, water, and air, and wildlife. So we wrote a set of bylaws, and we created a little organization, and we invited some individuals to be on the board. And we decided through that approach, or through that mission and through that vision, that we would have essentially four approaches. Again, envision that this is all a simple collaboration of individuals that can agree on an approach, and that landowners, private landowners, and maybe lessees, permittees, we're not there yet, we'll get there someday. It's hard for agencies to envision someone else benefiting from adjusted management on someone else's property, but we'll get there. That we look at strictly implementing a variety of approaches. So those are kind of in four quadrants: independently organized private transactions. So as we look out across the world, privately funded for private regulatory needs, regulated entities such as the oil and gas community, the transportation, home builders, things along those lines, those people that conventionally are looked at as being impacting conservation or impacting natural systems. They have regulatory needs. Mitigation is not a foreign term. But what is foreign is offsite mitigation in some cases that engages landowners that are maybe neighboring those entities. They will pay for that type of mitigation. They will pay for it to be implemented in a scientifically relevant way that's efficient with their resources. I think landowners can do that. We're going to talk a little bit about how a transaction actually can take place in a little bit. But they're also publicly organized for public benefit. So we know that agencies have participated a long time in conservation. We have a litany of Farm Bill programs. We have a litany of EPA programs. We have a litany of Fish and Wildlife Service programs that are out there that they fund for some specific reason, because a group of public or government felt that program needed to take place. And those will still continue to evolve in the future, and there are those that are relatively untapped, at least from a landowner's perspective and a conservation's perspective, that we can look at. One that's kind of emerging, and we've seen this on the recovery side of things, and we've seen this on maybe wetland banking and some things along those lines, some conservation banks, is this notion of trading credits. So that I realize that over a period of time that I may have an impact on a system or a specific animal or habitat, and that I maybe would want to purchase some credits up front, be an early actor with the assurance that when I do have that impact, that there's a system that recognizes that I can then debit my bank over here, and it really wouldn't slow me up tremendously in my development. Highways use this a lot with wetland banks, but there's this notion that most of these trading credit banks are a little bit reactive versus not. So some of the things that we're talking about now is how do you do this for instance, candidate species or species that aren't listed yet that really would be nice for all of us around the table to not have listed. It means we're doing a good job. And then this whole new realm of consumer or advocate preferred purchasing, branding, and investing type of conservation. There's some groups out there right now that are actually physically owning land. I've been in a personal conversation with an organization that would like to develop itself as a tradable investment, whereby they have some sort of portfolio of real land conservation and management intertwined into one that they can invest in and ultimately get a return out of at some point in time, as well as ongoing. Consumers are not ignorant. We know that in the beef industry really well. And we know that we are a consumer market-oriented entity. And conservation can't be anything different. So just because the bottle of cleaning solution is clear and it has an eco-friendly label on it, doesn't always mean that it's friendly to the environment, right? So we know that if we're going to do something that's consumer-based, and we know that those companies realize that it's got to actually mean something. So everybody that we've talked to on a corporate level that is interested in investing, their first question is now you're really going to have some sort of guarantee in place so that we can illustrate to our customers, and more importantly, our shareholders, that we're actually doing this. We're not just throwing money somewhere to get somebody to sign off on a piece of paper that says we're conservation minded. So companies are becoming very interested. Rick, you probably know about this when we've talked about the Coca-Cola project that's out there. Coca-Cola has a very distinct interest in mitigating the water that's used to process their product. Not the actual water in the bottle that goes into the product, but everything that goes into the production of that. They're very interested in that. As a beef producer, we're very interested in watching what our major marketing arms do as well. Walmart is an example, is a company that's going to develop a sustainability or greenness index for all products that are sold. And the beef industry is looking around at this point in time saying, we've got a lot of things that are kind of underway out there, nothing really perfected. We don't even know what the carbon footprint of our product may be exactly. We've got a great idea. But as I look at that, what Walmart's trying to do, whether it's through their greenness index or their locally purveyed products, what sort of market incentive are they going to offer in order to deliver those products that consumers want? So I'm interested in Walmart's approach here as we watch them long term. Are they going to be a company that's actually embracing what their consumers want and need, and they're prepared to prove that? Or are they a company that's simply going to be arbitrary and capricious in their approach? Not to offend anybody, but I'm very interested in that. I think their consumer base will be very interested in that as well. So this is actually pretty simple when it comes to responsibility flows for organizations, but this is essentially how a contract and a project works within Partners for Western Conservation. The organization's sole functions are to negotiate contracts, manage those systems, facilitate contractors, and ultimately maintain the agreements. They'll have a series of technical committees that they work with, and they don't do anything more or anything less than that. They bring everybody around the table. It's as simple as a company approaching us, and there'll be one that I'll meet with tomorrow morning and have a pretty extensive conversation. It's a project that hasn't been one like it completed in 60 years in the United States. And they will have an environmental impact that they have to mitigate. Yes, sir.
So, just so I understand, is the Partners for Western Conservation a spin? Is the Cattlemen's Association the originator of this work?
That they are. So let me back up and explain that very clearly. PWC, the vision for PWC was created by the Colorado Cattlemen's Association. We recognize a couple things. One is that it needs to be a separate organization for the sheer fact that if you want people to be part of it and to work with it, it has to be independent enough from CCA that they'll trust in. I think we're an integrity-based organization, but we also recognize that to have organizations like Environmental Defense and the Nature Conservancy and CSU and others around the table, we need to be somewhat independent of CCA. Now let me tell you the rest of the story. CCA appoints a fair amount of the board members, not the majority, and they're landowners. The rest of the appointments come from the board. The initiating landowners that are on the board here approached Environmental Defense, and they have an entity that sits on the board. So there are four landowners, three of which CCA appoints, one of which another statewide agriculture organization, in this case Farm Bureau, appoints. There's a commercial interest, and that individual is currently held by an oil and gas company, Bill Barrett Corporation. And an individual in that company that's fairly progressive and trying to change how the country does business related to their environmental impact. Environmental Defense Fund is an entity that believes in landowner incentivized conservation, and they hold a seat on this and were invited because of their evolution in conservation related to private landowners. They're an organization that was suing private landowners at one point in their life, and now they're actually developing programs with them. So we thought that that was a huge milestone. There's also a seat that remains vacant today, and that's for a wildlife entity. The board is pretty strident in their belief that it needs to be somebody from the State Game Management Agency, Division of Wildlife. We've yet to get them agreed to participate, but the seat's theirs and it sets them.
And the scope is Colorado or
it's a national nonprofit. It was created by Coloradans, essentially for Colorado, but they believe also that if this organization can serve anyone anywhere else, they're happy to do it. We've met with groups from other states and had conversations, and if we can help them in any way, we would be glad to, because it isn't an easy endeavor to fund one of these things with very little income coming in, so the Cattlemen's Association's agreed to do that. So, and it's also not a cheap thing to, an inexpensive thing to create the organization, so we've done that as well with some assistance, and if someone else can, if we can help them get up and running, we agreed to be able to. So that's a little bit about what it looks like structurally. They have an administrative contract that is offered and accepted by the Colorado Cattlemen's Association to do the work. In all essence of transparency, that contract is a contract that we're fulfilling for no income at this point in time, because we believe in it and our members believe in it.
And the money comes from where?
So let's walk through a transaction right quick. And we're going to use a hypothetical. We've got two or three in the queue right now. Some of that stuff's a little bit proprietary because of the negotiations that are taking place. But let's use what Colorado, let's use a gas company in Greater Sage Grouse Range that currently, in order for them to get a permit in Colorado, they've got to supply certain we'll just call them conservation strategies, things that they have to do in order to avoid, minimize, and mitigate their impacts on Greater Sage-Grouse habitat as well as the animals. That company will come to partners and say that we're seeking permitting in this area, let's say Moffett County, for 100 wells. And to get those wells permitted under state law, we can avoid, minimize in some cases, but in some cases we can't. We're going to have an impact. So we've got to mitigate that impact. So here are the things that we want. We want landowners to alter their management of their lands in order to create an additional conservation effect for the greater sage-grouse. We want them to not remove sagebrush. We want them to alter grazing practices in times of nesting, things along those lines. We want them to put in specific watering, different type of fencing, things along those lines. And also, as a company, we're going to do other things. We may do some directional drilling and some things along those lines. So it all kind of goes into the mix. most of the time, those companies have all done their baseline work already. They know what's out there, and we utilize that information both in the resource and the animals. And we put together a conservation plan with the assistance of, in this case, let's say, the Division of Wildlife, Colorado State University, and Environmental Defense, conservation organization. So this side of the table. And actually, it would kind of float to the other side now that the grouse is a candidate species. So we would involve the Fish and Wildlife Service as well. There's a lot of negotiation that goes on in these discussions. And there's a lot of changes that will take place in whatever that conservation plan looks like. But we'll ultimately get to a point where the company has been able to negotiate something that suffices for their permit. And they've done it in a least cost or more efficient way, because with these temporal type contracts, they're able to put more conservation dollars out on the ground in a wider area and have more of a prescriptive conservation effort in place. The negotiation unilaterally exists with the Division of Wildlife in this case, and ultimately for the oil and gas well, because they have to be sufficed for the conservation measure before the Oil and Gas Commission will offer the company a permit. So we'll deal with DOW to negotiate management agreements and what a contract will look like. And it will work for the company. And then we'll come back within Partners for Western Conservation, having negotiated what that will look like, and we'll author a request for proposal. And it will go out to landowners in the geographic area. And we'll ask landowners, based on what is in that RFP, to stipulate what they're willing to do, how they're willing to do it, in concert with RFP, and ultimately what they'll charge for. So, in agriculture, we're very familiar with auctions. And that's the way you maximize income and maximize quality. In this case, what you're doing is you're putting that out and you're allowing for a competitive bidding situation to take place on the RFP. It's like state contracting works, etc. And then the company will look at those RFPs or the proposals that come back in, and they will sort through them and then do an interview process and a discussion with the landowners to make sure that everybody's clear on what they bid in and how they bid it in, where they set. And that company doesn't always take the lowest bidder. They actually, and we've seen them gravitate toward maximizing conservation.
So it's the company that contracts with the landowners and pays them. It's not Partners for Western Conservation.
Partners is the conduit. We're an implementer. And I'll explain how the dollar transaction takes place, because there are several opportunities there. So generally it will be over the life of a well. There will be a couple different levels of conservation. There will be more intense conservation that takes place when drilling takes place. And then that will taper off throughout full reclamation, so 20, 25 years on the example that we're using here. Once a company chooses a suite of landowners or a landowner that they want to enter into a contract with, that's the other thing that Partners will do, is we bring attorneys in, we bring contractors in, we bring a series of individuals in to actually finalize the contracts. There may be a series of those contracts. They may be between Partners and the landowner and the oil and gas company. Division of Wildlife may emerge in those. CSU may be a part of those. A series of entities, because there's ongoing stewardship that needs to take place, as well as we have the baseline, but we also need to measure on an annual basis or somewhere there about what sort of conservation practices are taking place and what they're meaning. So Partners will facilitate that. We'll also facilitate the contractors. So for a landowner, a landowner doesn't always have to build a fence or put in the water treatment. We'll facilitate that. The other beauty of that is that we get paid to do it, and then we pay the contractors, so there's not a taxable moment for the landowner. So they don't have to deal with that issue either. So that's a secondary positive for the landowner, is they don't have to receive income and then expend the dollars to the contractor to build the fence or the water treatment or the water improvement, and then have to go through what always isn't necessarily 100% deduction for them. But that gets into some of the accounting detail. So once those contracts are finalized and the activity begins, again, there is some ongoing stewardship that has to take place. And that's where partners will work with CSU or private entities to go out on some sort of reoccurring basis and assure that the practice is taking place as prescribed by the contract. And then we'll also try to measure what sort of impact that practice is having. So in the case of sage grouse, are we seeing more birds in the area? Are there new leks showing up? Or is there a higher nesting and hatch success rate? Things along those lines. DOW also play a significant role in that. So it's really something that landowners are comfortable with, because landowners have dealt with in expansive periods of time and volume contracts. Contracts aren't foreign to them. They're familiar with them. Companies aren't foreign to contracts. They're familiar with them. Agencies aren't foreign to contracts. They're familiar with them. The example that I just gave was for mitigation, on only mitigation. There are a series of other things that we can use as tools. We can use things like candid conservation agreements, and I'll show you some of those. But let's run through, actually that's interesting. We'll see what we get here. Okay, so let's talk about the conservation benefits that exist here in this type of new strategy to get conservation on the ground. The positive thing is you're going to secure habitat across a wider geography to offset losses. It's very expensive to buy land. In some ways, it's very expensive to ease land, and it's more of a passive conservation tool. This is more of a prescriptive conservation tool, so we know that we can spread money further. There's a net gain in suitable habitat for species. So all of these contracts, be it for mitigation or whatever, can't just be a one-to-one offset. Additionality is important. You've got to go above and beyond what the impact is to really have it be meaningful to people. The big thing that not only agencies see value in, but conservationists see value in, is there's a huge reservoir of the unknown out there related to natural resources, species, and habitat. We ground truth this with the assistance of CSU in southeastern Colorado through something called the Southeastern Colorado Biological Inventory. Our land trust participated in, our group of landowners in that area participated in. Landowners have a great sense of what's there, they just don't know how to measure it. Day in, day done, after both of those inventories were done, part one, part two, there were species that existed down there nobody knew existed in Colorado. Okay? Landowners saw them, but they weren't sure what they were. Restoration of important ecosystems on public and private lands. So that's one side of the equation that we can get for the conservation community. What's in it for the landowner and the business side of the community? We keep working lands working. There's operational certainty for a variety of industries, which is important because of this ecosystem we live in. It entertains people as well. There's a long-term benefit to species not being listed. We've got to get ahead of the conservation curve. We don't have the money, we don't have the resources, we don't have the time, so we've got to think about these new tools in order to get ahead of when species are being listed and then we become reactive. It is a proactive approach, so it maintains land use. I'm going to skip over this right quick because I think you know the point that I'll just make off of that previous slide is that regulation is expensive and it's reactive. And the day to rely on regulation for conservation is over, in my opinion. We've got to get ahead of the curve and become more successful. We talked about mitigation agreements. They're widely used. They can be banked in Colorado. Oil and gas, transportation builders are the ones that are primarily using those. They work on and off site. Granted, localized, you can't mitigate an impact in another state or something. It's been tried, and that concept wasn't really successful. And we can do it with both listed and non-listed species. Briefly, I'm going to point out tools that exist within the federal system. Fish and Wildlife Service and BLM and Forest Service, Canada Conservation Agreements and Canada Conservation Agreements with Assurances, one on federal lands, two on private lands. These are agreements that have been used throughout time, but with the Fish and Wildlife Service, they're a proven tool. They're tools that are now landowners and permittees are starting to engage in fairly successfully. They're very expensive and time consuming. Partners can hold a Canada Conservation Agreement and actually offer it to the Fish and Wildlife Service for their use. It's a Canada Conservation Agreement, and I can get you information on it. Canada Conservation Agreement with Assurances. Rick can also help on that. We talked a little bit about credit systems. This is something that we're working with Environmental Defense today. Didn't format quite right, but to try to see if we can come up with a credit-based pilot project in Colorado for Canada species. So I'm gonna kind of leave that at that because we're trying to get a foothold in that doorway because we really think that that's an important thing. So here's my synopsis of why PWC was needed and essentially what our membership was telling us. Regulation doesn't work, but regulators do. This is a food issue as well. The UN's telling us that we need 70% more food by 2050. That's as much food as we've produced in this country in the last 12,000 years. And the only way you're going to get that is to have viable agricultural entities out there. So this is a win-win for everybody. If we can invest through conservation back into ranches and farms and keep them ranches and farms, your secondary effect is going to be that you're going to eat in 20 or 30 years. It's diversification for agriculture. This is the point we have to tell our members repeatedly because they look at this and they say, well, I'm selling out my heritage. I'm not raising cattle solely just because I want to raise cattle. That's okay. There are other business endeavors that a lot of companies participate in and they honor their heritage and it's an okay thing. Active conservation of resources, not passive and hoping for the best. We're doing that today. We're hoping that we put things on the ground. We're hoping that we invest in conservation and ultimately what does it mean in the long run? We have to measure what our effects are. And if they're not meaning something, we have to change the way we're doing business. We have to sideline emotion and reinvest in our institutions and our own operations on a scientific level. We have less dollars. And it's a conduit for agricultural literacy. This slides a lot for our membership, but it's also, I think, good to show others is that we need to start to communicate what agricultural operations landowners can do for society as a whole beyond just providing meat if you choose to eat meat, beyond providing wheat if you choose to eat bread. There's a lot of other benefits that agricultural lands as a reservoir of resources out there can provide to society as a whole. This is a new way of doing business. I'm gonna leave you with 2 points. We're actually doing some work today, but we're very much drawing a philosophical line in the sand from an agriculture landowner's perspective. A lot of this is yet to be evolved. You can't simply walk through the door, you can try today, as the Colorado Cattlemen's Association say, I want to be paid for providing X habitat. We'll put it out there for you. There are groups that are doing that. I'm not going to guarantee you, though, that you're going to get a phone call back from us really quickly saying somebody wants to pay you. So we've got to change the way that business is being done. And the only way that we're realizing we can do that, and we've tried to do it just through conversation, is to actually put projects on the ground and actually propose projects to those that ultimately can tell us if we can do them or we can't. And guess what? We'll get them done. We're getting them done. And I think we'll see measurable difference. So appreciate your time, appreciate the opportunity. Be glad to hang around and answer questions, but I think I'm up against about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Terry. That was great, and yeah, let's informally, if we have any questions, come up and talk to Terry, because I know people have to go to other classes and other meetings. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
Thanks, buddy.
Appreciate it. Yeah, there's a lot.